Unfettered Mind.
Hello, I'm Ken MacLeod, and welcome to this 10-part series on Dakini Practice. Dakini Practice can be seen as a way to refine experience and as a tool to raise energy. This recording, made during a retreat, gives specific practice instructions for each of the five Dakinis. However, before delving into the specifics, let's begin with an overview of Dakinis and their relationship with timeless awareness. Here is part one.
Mercury was the symbol for fire in the system of humors. Air refers to all of the thinking beliefs. And again, void is the space in which all of those emotional movements can arise, or activity arises. And then we get to up to the mind, where mind is. The earth refers to mind as ground. Now, mind as ground means that there is no ground. That quality of presence. And then water refers to the clarity. Fire refers to the knowing quality of mind. You just know. And air refers to the way mind moves, as I said earlier, thinking. And void is the aspect of mind in which there's nothing you can name there. So these are five elements form a language in which we can describe all of these different aspects of our experience. And it's actually helpful to become conversant in this language, which is one of the reasons, one of the objectives for this retreat, is to gain, to develop some familiarity and become conversant with the language, because it becomes extremely useful, not only in terms of transforming the way that we experience things, but also in actually just interacting with things. Understanding things in terms of the elements. And what the Dakinis are, I'm going to talk a little bit about Dakinis. You have a question, John?
The distinction, could you further give some clarification on the difference between fluidity and water and movement and air?
Ah, well, that's something we'll go into. More detail. What's the difference between the fluidity of water and the movement of air? Water, when it flows, stays together. Air just moves. For instance, if water is still, you can still sense it. But you can only sense air when there's movement. For instance, you hold a hand up, you don't feel any air. When you do this, you feel air. So if there's no movement, there's actually, you could say there's no air. But water has a cohesive quality. So some people say it's a cohesive element, but that runs into the solidity aspect also. So that's why I say it's flow. Flow keeps some kind of form, but movement doesn't necessarily keep any form. The water element assumes the form of whatever it's flowing in. Now, let's talk a little bit about the Dakinis. The Dakinis, the origin of the Dakinis, these were the ascription of aspects of experience to supernatural entities that were called in India Dakinis. Nichit Dorje, one of the Paramahansas, wrote a very nice little bit about Dakinis. I didn't actually bring with him. In which he describes the origin of some of a group of four Dakinis, which do correspond to the first four of the elements, earth, water, fire, and air. The water element, for instance, corresponds to the Dakini whose name is Changeling. Changeling was this spirit or demon that would appear to you in different forms and seduce you into doing things that were really bad for you, I think. Another one was called the murderers. These were regarded as female entities. There were, in Indian lore, also male entities. They were called Dakas, and Dakini is the female form. And they were originally supernatural spirits. What happens in Vajrayana is that these elements of folklore, and the way that experience was interpreted, then became symbols for how for the way mind works. Does anybody have a copy of my book right here? Thanks very much. It's in here. Thank you for this. And I included this song by Chupa Naldra, which probably all of you have read. But it describes what the crucial element is. The ordinary Dakini represents these unruly aspects of our mind, the wild, untamed, reactive mind, which just takes over. So he says, when wanting and grasping hold sway, the Dakini has you in her power. Wanting nothing from outside, taking things as they come, know the Dakini to be your own mind. And what's being expressed here is whatever arises in experience, when we regard it as something other, then attraction, aversion, all of the reactive emotions operate. And we are in the thrall of dualistic fixation, dualistic interpretation, and alienated from our own nature, our own norm, and just react to those. That's what it means when it says that the Dakini has us in her power. Then he says, wanting nothing from outside, taking things as they come, those are meditation instructions. Wanting nothing from outside. Now, how much of our lives do we go around trying to get something from the world to make us feel better? Relationships, money, possessions, you know, the list just goes on and on. And we're trying to get all these things from outside to make us feel good in some way. Does it work? Well, no, it doesn't work. It never works. It's temporary at best. But does that stop us from doing it? No, we keep doing it. Taking things as they come. This, again, is a meditation instruction. All too often, most of the time, in fact, we don't take things as they come. Something arises and we want it to be a little bit different. That's not quite right. Many years ago, I had a girlfriend who was just exactly right. I was never quite right. I never quite fit like the picture. It was very difficult. Know the Dakini to be your own mind. That is, know that what arises in experience is not something other. Now, when we know that, and this is not an intellectual knowing, this is an experiential knowing, then everything changes. The way that we experience the world changes. And so rather than being fixed in this dualistic I-other framework, when we know what arises in experience to be our own mind, now there is no dualism. There is just experience. And we're away from that experience. So he goes on to say, know that the crystal is the non-thought of mind itself, and the crystal that Dakini guards against interruptions. This is very deep instruction. The crystal, you can regard this as the water of Dakini. Crystal is the non-thought of mind itself. So, when you have a level of attention in which you can rest and there's no conceptual process taking place in the mind, no thought, then things can arise. And it doesn't matter what arises, it doesn't disturb. And thus, nothing can interrupt the quality of your attention and the quality of your presence. Know that the source of wealth is contentment, and the jewel to King knows all wants and needs. There's a story from the life of Buddha. In which a very poor person, comes across this wish-fulfilling jewel. He recognizes what he's found. And he says, wow, this is so important and valuable. I don't know what to do with this. The Buddha will know what to do with it. So he went to Buddha and said, I found this wish-fulfilling jewel. I don't know what to do with it, but you'll know the person who needs this the most. So I'm going to give it to you. So he said, thank you. Later that day, there was a big festival. And sponsored by the local ruler and king. And in the middle of this festival, Buddha called the king and said, here's this wish-fulfilling jewel. I was told to give it to the person who needs it most. I'm giving it to you. He said, why? He said, because you have more want than anybody else in this kingdom. So, no contentment. When there's no contentment, it doesn't matter how wealthy we are. And we can think of wealth in terms of financial wealth or possessions, but it doesn't really matter. It applies to other kinds of wealth. Some people are greedy for knowledge. Some people are greedy for connection. Some people are greedy for power. It doesn't make any difference. When there's no contentment, then the jewel Dakini had us in her power. When we know contentment, then we are the richest person in the world because we don't need anything. So This is how the Dakinis transform experience. And that's what we're going to be working with explicitly. The five Dakinis symbolize the five elements. So, and there are many systems of Dakinis. This is the one we're going to use here. So the Earth Dakini symbolizes the nurturing, supportive, powerful quality of Earth. And instead of that rigid solidity, she symbolizes stability. And there are similar ones for the other elements. The water Dakini symbolizes the clarity that I referred to of nature and mind. So instead of this not being able to pin anything down, this constant movement of dissipating energy, which is what the ordinary water reaction is, there's a clarity. So you know what's actually happening. In every element of passion, fire, there's a knowing. Often that knowing is confused and distorted. What the fire that human symbolizes is the knowing that just arises without any reference and knows things directly and intimately. The air Dakini transforms busyness and activity for activity's sake into effective action. And the void Dakini transforms that spacey, bewildered quality of experience into presence, oneness. And in making those transformations, then the Dakinis open the doors, or the doors are open for us, to the five aspects of pristine awareness. Now, the five aspects of pristine awareness, we've heard many times, some of you. The usual translations are evenness or sameness, pristine awareness. That corresponds to earth. Mirror-like pristine awareness corresponds to water. Distinguishing pristine awareness, which corresponds to fire. It's usually translated as accomplishing pristine awareness, which I think is a completely brain-dead translation. I translated it as effective pristine awareness, which corresponds to air. And totality pristine awareness which some of you know as Dhammadhatu, the Sanskrit word for it. Which corresponds to the void. Now I've been playing, in place of evenness, pristine awareness, I've been playing with the translation of balanced pristine awareness. Balance is a very important term in Dzogchen teachings. The Tibetan is Nyanmi, and it's usually translated as sameness or evenness. It is what it's the literal translation. Nyan is the word for even, and Mi is the word for ness. So it makes a noun out of it. But I was having a discussion with a very knowledgeable Tibetan one 2 years ago. And I said, you know, why don't you give me a Tibetan word for balance? And he went, he said, yam yin. I went, oh, that's very interesting. Because balance, in a certain sense, is like the ground of presence, in that balance is the optimal condition for presence to arise. And what balance consists of is a complete absence of preference and prejudice, so you can experience everything as just experience. And that's exactly what this aspect of pristine awareness is about, experiencing things as just experience. Nothing is better or worse, bigger or lesser than anything else. Everything is experience. Mirror-like pristine awareness is referring to the clarity aspect of experience. And this is very important. When you look into a mirror, what do you see?
A face.
Yeah, or you see reflections. You know, you may be looking at an angle and reflection. But you see your own face, you're looking straight into it. Or if you're looking at an angle, you see reflections. Okay. Question. Do you see the mirror? No, then you see the dirt. Right? Now, we know there's a mirror there, unless for a cat or something like that, then we don't know there's a mirror. Or we may not know there's a mirror there, we may think there's something, because we can't tell. But usually we know there's a mirror there because there's a frame around it, there's something else. But you actually can't see a mirror, can you? Mm-hmm. You follow? In the same way, when we look at what we experience, what we're actually looking at is our own mind. That's why it's called mirror-like pristine awareness. You look around this room, you see everybody in the different poses and colors and shapes and so forth. And all there is sensory experience. We're looking at our own mind. But we can't see it. And what's more problematic, it's not that we can't see it, it's that we can't see mind at all. But we think we're looking at actual people that really exist there. And we have no idea at all that what we're seeing is actually our own mind. That's the mirror-like pristine awareness. And then there's distinguishing pristine awareness. I've never been happy with that term either, but I haven't found a better one. Give me another 5 years, maybe I'll come up with one. What this means is seeing the individual aspects of every aspect of it, as every bit of experience. Now, in its ordinary functioning, this is what leads to a lot of judgment. You see this over here and that over here.
Could you repeat that again? Seeing the individual aspects?
Yeah. For instance, being able to see the different colors in the carpet. Seeing all the individual qualities and differentiating. Buddhism has a very simple definition of intelligence. It's actually a very effective definition. Intelligence is the ability to discern differences. Now, when it comes to buying a carpet, I'm not very intelligent because I can't discern differences. You know, in terms of quality of the weave, and the quality of the material, and the quality of the design, etc., etc. But someone who's very knowledgeable about carpets is able to discern. In that particular context, they're much more intelligent. But there are other areas where I can discern differences. And so being able to see these differences, that's what makes us able to see what's what. Now, it's a little bit out of fashion these days because people think, well, that's being, you know, discriminating. But being able to see what's actually there and how it's different from other things that are there, that's all information. And we need that information in order to know how to act and respond to situations. And that quality, that being able to see all of those differences very, very clearly, that's the part, that's distinguishing pristine awareness, which corresponds to pride. And let's face it, when you have a passion for things, then you really get into those distinctions. Get somebody who's really passionate, a couple of people who are really passionate about music, and they'll talk about minute differences. You know, well, he played that track this way, when he should have played this way, and so forth. It's an indication of passion. That effective pristine awareness is how I like to translate that one. It's about effective action, as I said earlier. It's the quality of experience which knows what to do and just does it. Cutting through all the stuff. Its symbol is the sword, because it cuts through confusion. Cuts through duality. And then there's the totality of pristine awareness, which is the quality of awareness which knows everything. Knows the whole. And those of you who are familiar with Tibetan Buddhism know that there's a lot of word that comes up repeatedly in prayers of praise and so forth is omniscient, which is a translation of Tibetan Tamche Chenpa. Tamche is the word for all, and Chenpa is the word to know, the omniscient. And so we translate this as, first, it sounds perfectly reasonable, omniscient, omni being the Latin word for all, and cien comes from the Latin word to know, knowing everything. But we do something a little differently there. Because we're in a modern culture, we tend to take this literally. Knowing everything means literally knowing everything. So somebody asks, so-and-so knows everything, and they ask them some obscure question about economic theory or biological theory. They don't know it. And I think this is a complete misunderstanding. And, you know, this kind of knowing is not a super PhD. It's complete knowing. So it's knowing our experience in the moment completely. I think that's a much better way of approaching that term, rather than getting into just what obviously isn't true, is that people who have a high level of attention can know completely the experience of now. And that has extraordinary power in and of itself. So what I've tried to do now is just go through the five elements, give you a flavor for those, go through the five dakinis, give you some kind of flavor for them, and go through the five pristine awarenesses. Now, one may ask, well, why the feminine? In Buddhism, the feminine always symbolizes the wisdom aspect. And we're working very much with the wisdom aspect in the context of this retreat. And one can explore that as much as one wants. The wisdom aspect is very much connected with the empty aspect. The emptiness of knowing, this may sound a little tautological, but the emptiness of knowing is what makes knowing possible. Now, what we're going to be doing in the course of this retreat, we'll be doing two or three different things. One is, starting tomorrow, I'm not going to start doing this tonight, we're going to go through the meditations of the Dakinis. During the teaching sessions, I'll probably go through them in terms of a guided meditation, so that we get very clear about how the meditation proceeds, and a lot of people find it helpful being walked through it and follow it from that. That's one thing, so you learn those techniques. The structure of each of those meditations is very similar. You invoke the presence of the Dakini, invite transformation, experience the illumination of one's reactive patterns or the reactive chains, the transformation that comes through a higher level of attention, and then the flavor or the gesture with the pristine awareness and the way of experiencing the world, that aspect of pristine awareness embodies. And we will go through this in a ritual, dramatic form. It's visualized, it's imagined if you wish. Symbols are used because the symbols speak directly to us emotionally, bypassing the cognitive process, which often introduces a whole element of distortion and interpretation, which isn't necessary. So it's a way of working very directly with the process of the mind. Now, what each of these meditations describes is what we are actually aiming to be able to do with experience when it arises. And I'll be making those links so that, for instance, with earth element, when you begin to feel the rigidity, if you open to the experience of rigidity, you transform that rigidity into a sense of stability which doesn't require an external reference. And that makes it possible to experience everything as just experience. So you've moved into the pristine awareness. But I'll be going through those processes in more details when we go through the meditations. So that's one thing we're going to be doing, and that's how you learn how to transform reactive processes. Basically, the meditation on each of the Dakinis is training in a specific transformation process, which when you train deeply enough, starts to happen in your life, and so you start experiencing the world differently. It's not that you remember to do it; it doesn't operate that way. You train it so that it just happens. Then, so that's one. Yes.
Does it happen on the spot, or does it happen upon reflection?
It happens on the spot. Initially, it may happen on reflection, but that's really after the fact. Aim here is you train it so thoroughly that it just happens. You don't think about it, you don't remember to do it, it just happens. And that requires a high level. Okay. Second thing we're going to be doing is learning the language of the five elements, which I referred to earlier. So, in this light evening read, You'll find you can mark them this up quite a bit. Pardon? It helps. I think I've had a good editor, but the 100 pages less. On pages, starting on page 226 and going through to page 231, you'll find descriptions of each of the elements in terms of aspects of ordinary experience. So it'd be good to spend one day on each element. Read over that section. So we'll do earth tomorrow. We'll be a little short on wood, so that'll be on Sunday, we only have half a day. But you spend one day observing earth. Read over that section, all of the questions that it has, and you reflect on earth element in your life and earth element around. So you really use that that framework to become very, very familiar with it. So that's the second thing that we're going to be doing, becoming familiar with the language. Third thing is that we're going to do a number of exercises over the course of the retreat. This is what I usually do in the afternoons. And these exercises are designed to bring you in touch with specific aspects of the element, so you get what each element feels like in the body. And that can be fun, it can be interesting. And if you won't do that tomorrow afternoon, we're just going to have tomorrow afternoon off to catch up from our busy hectic life to make adjustment to the retreat. So tomorrow's Wednesday, so Thursday, Friday, Saturday, which is just about like, I think I can come up with three sets of exercises. So you get the experience of the elements and also the transformation of the elements right into the body. So they just aren't abstract ideas, but you actually have a physical experience associated with it. So that's the third thing we're going to do. Is that enough? Do you want more? No. One time I taught this retreat, we had a full 5 days, I think it was a 6 day retreat, so we had 5 days, one for each element. I kept adding more and more stuff. By day three, everybody's eyes had glazed over. As people said, Ken, have you ever heard that less is more? I said, no, more is more. Less is less, more is more. Questions?
Real quickly, will you bring our book?
This? For the practices?
Just for the review.
For the review? I'm hoping that when you've gone through this with the guided meditation, etc., that's why we gave you this, because we have here a handy-dandy chart.
We
haven't given them off yet. George is, I don't know, for how many years now have you been doing this?
Two minutes.
But, a month or a month and a half, he calls me up and says, Ken, we need the booklet for the next retreat. He's so reliable about that. And I go, oh, yes, you're right. And so each time we put together this booklet, and this is the booklet for that. Now, this, you'll find in here a rather strange, perhaps you could do that. I decided to make the work easier today. And if you look on page 8 in here, probably should have called this the Song of the Elements rather than Song of the Bikinis, but we read that from the title song. You'll see that there are these two verses. EJ. Does everyone have one? Everybody got one? So if you read through them, you'll see the whole meditation, or you see points from that. That's how it works right there. We're going to read this every day.
Where are we on the chair?
Page 8. I composed this in order so that you have something to read and actually get the stuff into you, because I ask people to memorize the stuff, and nobody ever does. So I decided to force it to you. So I think you'll find that helpful. Look at the beginning to me too. So you've got that, and you've got the chart. So there's a lot of stuff to learn here. I think between those two things, we'll have nothing to write. We won't have to have to be reading text or meditation. Yes?
Have you ever seen a person that has achieved all these? How do they behave in life when they can do all these things? What do they look like?
How do we know them all? Very unremarkable. That's what they look like. Why? Well, as one develops a higher level of attention and frees oneself from the tyranny of reactive processes, then you see things more clearly. The more clearly you see things, the more clearly you see what's required in each situation. When you're really clear, usually you only see one thing to do in each situation. And so you just do it. It's no big deal. And things just flow naturally, because it is what is appropriate. And nobody notices. So if you come across a person who seems totally unremarkable, and things just seem to flow around that person, probably good to pay attention. Mm-hmm. Not magical. One second, if I'll give you an example. So I use these techniques in my corporate consulting as well. I was working with the COO in the organization and corporation, who had a very, very volatile CEO, a very fiery guy who was constantly losing his temper and challenging and intimidating and turning the company upside down about one thing after another. And he said, "What do I do with this guy, Ken? He keeps taking us off what we really need to be focusing on and disrupting us and taking care of things that should be being taken care of at levels much lower down. What do I do with this guy?" I said, "Well, the next time he blows his stack about something, just look at him and say, I know this is a difficult situation. We're going to get through this together. And, guy looked at me and said, "What?" I said, "Don't ask any questions. Just say that to him." "Okay." So I saw him a couple of weeks later. I said, "Well, how'd it go?" He said, "It was really weird. I did what you said, and you got really upset about something last week. I did what you said. I just said, it's a really difficult situation. We're going to get through this together. Don't worry about it." He just looked at me and said, "Huh? Let's get back to work." And that was it.
way that works, and we'll be going into this later, is that the fire element reaction, why a person is so explosive, is that they feel completely alone. They feel isolated. Mm-hmm. And they fear, that they're afraid of being isolated. Everything's going to be on them. So when I told the CEO, just say, this is a difficult situation, we're going to get through this together, there was a connecting comment. And it diffused the fire reaction in the CEO just like that. He didn't even know he was feeling that. He just went, huh? Let's get back to work. And so, but it's what acting he needed. So it really looks very unremarkable that things flow. Okay? Dick, you had a question.
That's great. I keep having this question about suppose we were in a different culture, right?
Suppose we're in different cultures. Dick,
I'm in a different culture, and I don't speak the same language as anybody in this room.
Okay.
And I'm presented with these some sort of rule.
Yeah.
And I don't understand the wording. Are those symbols going to speak to my unconscious?
No, I don't want them to speak to your unconscious at all. I want them to speak to you.
Well, but when you say that words distort.
Okay, so your question is, will these symbols, and you name some of them, the circle of light and the sword, a rose or a lotus, red one, mirror and jewel, will they speak to you? Okay. When you think of a jewel, what comes to mind?
A jewel?
Yes. What else comes to mind? What does a jewel symbolize for you? Just forget everything. Just what is a jewel? You know, this beautifully cut, rich yellow jewel.
I think that's the point, right? I get a myriad of images.
Yeah, well, so give us two or three. If you get a myriad, you can give us two or three.
I see a ring with a jewel in it. Right. For some reason, I see a roulette wheel. I don't know why. Mm-hmm. So I feel like...
Just a second. Okay. And what's a common feature there? Ring, roulette... It starts with R.
Well, I was going to say circle, and it's the wheel.
Well, there's that, but there's also a quality of richness, isn't there?
I wouldn't call it that originally. That's what bothers me about this. Is that I feel like the image is like, I'm not on track here.
Well, you'll get the images you get, Adam. I'm pretty sure it's going to be fine.
Okay.
There's two points. Can we close up those? The mosquitoes are starting to come in.
Yeah,
I'm
starting.
They've been okay. Well, they found me finally. How are you doing, Brian?
I'm well.
You're feeling chewed, in other words. There we go.
Can I think my question here is, we can't do this without the words. You can't separate the symbols from the words, right?
Agreed. You can't separate the symbols from the words. But there's thinking about, and there's letting the symbols speak to you. I mean, everybody has a certain association with the sword. You know, if I put a sword in the center of the room, you can guarantee everybody would go like this. You know, it would be a shift, because that has a certain meaning. It may have more meaning in some cultures, or meanings in different directions in some cultures than others, but it has a meaning. We all know what a sword is.
Well, I wouldn't get that far. I'd want to know if the sword is pointing down or pointing up, or is it double-bladed? Is it kind of twisty handle and trying to make that funny. It's coming off. I can't.
Okay, so what's your favorite sword?
I'm not a sword guy.
Yeah, but when you think of a sword, what comes to mind?
It's going to point up for me. It's going to be double bladed. It's going to be.
And you know what? That's exactly the same. I guess you were on track on that one. Okay. Red Rose, you had a problem with that?
My instinct was to go with a Lotus.
Okay. You like Lotus better than Rose? It's a red, deep red flower. Mm-hmm. Okay. Many petals. Rich. Very passionate. Red roses, red lotus, they were used in their cultures for exactly the same thing. It's what you gave to women when you're asking them out. Okay? Good. Right. Other questions? Jeremy?
It would be helpful to have the phrases. So you're with fire, you're comforting them in that they're not alone.
Oh, we'll be going through all of that. That's, I'm not going to give you that tonight, that would be overkill. But we'll be going through the exercises, things like that, so you'll know all of that. Yes.
I think the question of this woman asked about what does that person look like is very important, because I think probably all of us want to be able to translate what we're learning into our actual experience of being present.
Yes. I agree the question is very important, and I answered it the way I did, because I don't want you to try to emulate anything.
Okay.
This is not about emulation. This is about, and that's a lot of what we do in our culture is when you see somebody and you try to act like them and try to emulate them. But emulation, all that does is gives us a way of acting. It doesn't necessarily change anything inside.
But if we're in really difficult situations and we find ourselves making, you know, almost on the spot making a choice, okay, am I going to get in there and fight this battle, or am I going to, you know, step out of it, or am I going to, you know, how will I engage in the turmoil of whatever is happening to you?
Well, we're going to talk about that. But what we're training to do is when that turmoil comes up, is to recognize we're in turmoil and then move into the experience of the turmoil.
Which could mean being reactive?
No. We're reactive when we don't move into the experience of the turmoil. Then it just runs. So we're going to move into the experiences of the turmoil. And so far more important, from my point of view, is not about describing what behave like this, because people will adopt those behaviors, and it won't come from any wisdom or knowing inside. My aim is, in our time together here, is to give you the tools and help guide you in your experience, so that you start discovering these qualities in your own experience, and then how that takes expression in your own experience will take care of itself. And you're not going to be emulating anybody. You're going to be acting directly from your own mind, which is the intention of Buddhism. And emulation is a method of practice, but it's really a relatively beginner's method of practice. We are much more concerned really discovering the abilities and qualities in your own experience and learning how to give expression to them. Other questions? Okay. Yes?
You talked about machinery or more machinery. Does that mean that this type of practice can help those of us with less stable and less strong attention eventually perhaps seize or directly experience emptiness, even if just for a moment?
Well, experience emptiness is very easy. That's not what particularly difficult. Living from emptiness, that's much, much more difficult. Basically,
fair enough. Maybe I should say stabilizing.
Yeah, stabilizing. Well, the stabilizing experience of emptiness is purely a matter of developing a sufficient level of attention. Right now, we have all kinds of reactive processes running around inside us which keep destabilizing our attention. And so, one of the reasons we do the practices such as the five dakinis or the four immersibles or any of these things is to knock out key components of the reactive process so they stop operating and then our attention naturally becomes more stable. And then being able to live in the sense of emptiness and experience becomes more possible. So we're creating the conditions for that to arise. But there's a huge amount of mystification. If you read the Mahayana Sutras, they're wonderful. They're beautiful. They're elaborate. And they leave you the impression that you don't have a chance, snowball's chance in hell of ever being awake. Right?
The Heart Sutra.
Well, the Heart Sutra is relatively innocuous. You type try the Avatamsaka Sutra, and it just goes on and on and on. Even the Dhyana Sutra is very intimidating that way. But when you get to the core experiences that we're talking about, for instance, how many of you have heard about the four stages of arhatship? You know, stream winner, and once returner, and no returner, and arhatship, right? Yeah, except what the blazes does this mean? Okay. What's a stream winner? Now, it's someone who, and you read the formal descriptions, and you feel like, well, you know, maybe 25 lifetimes, if I work absolutely consistently, I don't do anything else, I never earn a cent in my life, I just meditate all the time. Maybe I'll just get there, like that, right? Well, those wonderful descriptions are an expression of how much people valued this. They blew it up tremendously. But what is a stream winner? A stream winner is a person who has had a sufficiently powerful or strong experience of how things actually are, emptiness, that they can't go back to being the same way. So it's something which screws up the system, so you can't go back. Now you're on the path. You run the stream. So when you develop a level of attention, so you have that experience, then you're a stream winner. What's a once returner? A once returner is a person whose level of attention is sufficiently high so that when a reactive process comes up, they get caught by it, and then they wake up. Okay. No returner is one who, when a reactive process arises, it just comes and goes. They don't have to come back. And so what you have here is, in this highly metaphorical language, you have actually very, very simple processes expressed in code. These experiences are very accessible to all of us. Okay. And the idea that they're remote and way, way out there, well, that's poetry.
But they are taken literally, right? So. Some of my teachers, anyway.
Actually, someone sit in the room here.
Well, kind of Zen who had very, very deep experience at one point. And he, the circumstances were such that he couldn't go to any teacher and have his experience, recount his experience and have it reflected back, which is actually a very important aspect. So in lieu of that, I think he picked up the Diamond Sutra and said to himself, if I can read this and understand it without having a single thought, then I think I'm probably on the right track. That's what he did. And it's all just absolutely clear. So when you've had certain experiences, then you see what the poetry is actually pointing to. Now, in Eastern teachers, many of them, almost all of them, they learned and were trained in this highly metaphorical way of expression. At the same time, because they're in traditional societies, they don't take it literally. They understand and know it as metaphor, though they don't talk about it as metaphor. It's not the way one does in the traditional society. We're have been grown up in a modern society. Modern society is characterized by the use of rational processes, particularly in science, in which you take everything absolutely literally. When you're reading an account of a scientific experiment, you're paying attention to every word that's being very clearly expressed because you want to reconstruct that experiment to see if you can do it yourself. So you take everything absolutely literally. But then we bring that literalness to this highly metaphorical thing, and the result is disastrous. I'll give you an example. I ran into this with a psychologist that I was having a conversation with, exactly this conversation. He said, well, give me an example. He said, in Tibetan Buddhism, we regard your teacher as Buddha. And he immediately said, oh, so he's infallible. I said, no. That's a perfect example of modern, literal, rational processes being applied to metaphorical language, or mythic language. When you say you regard your teacher as a Buddha, as Buddha, it describes the way that you regard your teacher is how you experience awakening mind telling you how to look at it. It doesn't say anything about the infallibility of that person. What it says a great deal about is your relationship to that person and the role of that relationship in your spiritual practice, which is a huge difference from talking about a person as being infallible. Not the same thing at all. And those kinds of mistakes are being made all over the place. Okay. Other questions?
I just want, yeah. Doesn't that build on a little bit of our Christian heritage where the image of Jesus and some of those images are so pure and rarefied that we in our culture transport those into Tibetan culture or the Eastern religion cultures?
I think a lot of the symbology in Christianity is equally as misunderstood.
And goes with that as well, yeah, hand in hand with that.
Yeah. I think the being able to understand what is being pointed to in terms of one's own experience without a literal description, being able to understand what the mythic language is pointing to is something that is being lost to a significant extent, which means that we lack a way of talking about these things. And that's problematic. Yeah, I'm going to discuss the technical aspects of the retreat. So I think we're through. Is there anything else? We're through this aspect of tonight.
a long time to happen back then, so I still have a number of things to do this year.
Unfettered Mind retains all rights to these podcasts. If you wish to use part or a whole podcast, please send an email to podcasts@unfetteredmind.org.